Korea, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities.
Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, celebrating cultural diversity with the artists of the Fez Festival of Sacred Music on March 30th through 31st, and Santur Virtuoso Manuher Sadahi on April 1st. For more information, visit krannertcenter.com.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. When the prescription painkiller OxyContin was first introduced back in 1996, it brought relief to a lot of people who were suffering with chronic pain. And it had a special feature that made it very useful. It was designed with a time-release feature. So people who were suffering with cancer or suffering pain after surgery, for example, could take one pill and that it would allow them to get a good night's sleep. However, this drug also had a dark side. It was potentially highly addictive, and it wasn't very long before abusers discovered that by simply crushing the pill, they could get around this time-release function, and they could get the full dose of the drug all at once. And very quickly, it became a serious problem. And in fact, while marijuana remains the nation's most abused drug, according to government and private studies, narcotic pain relievers like OxyContin, along with some other prescription medications, have now overtaken amphetamines to rank number two. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we will talk about some of the troubling issues raised by the painkiller OxyContin. And our guest for the program is Barry Meyer. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize for his work in 2002. He was recipient of a George Polk Award for Outstanding Journalism. He's written quite a bit on the subject of OxyContin and also now is the author of a book-length treatment of the issue. The book is titled Painkiller. That's as two words. The subtitle, A Wonder Drug's Trail of Addiction and Death, and it's published by Rodale. It's out now. Questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. And that's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Meyer, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Very good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. The active ingredient in the drug, in OxyContin, was something that had been around. It was in other medications and different kind of formulations. And in fact, the manufacturer of OxyContin did have another kind of drug that was similar, that used the same active ingredient. What was different about OxyContin when it came on the market?
Well, two things were essentially different about OxyContin. One was the drug in terms of the formulation of the drug. You're absolutely right. The active narcotic, a drug called oxycodone, has long been used in other painkillers that are known under brand names like Percocet, Percodan, Tylox. But OxyContin was unique in that it had very high levels of this particular drug, this narcotic, because it was intended, as you said earlier, to last for 12 hours. These other drugs are short-acting drugs. So that made it unique. What also made it unique is that it got a special label from the FDA. The FDA and the manufacturer thought that because it was a longer-acting drug, it would be less attractive to people who abuse drugs because people tend to like a quick hit from a drug, so it got a label that said it might be less prone to abuse or have less abuse appeal than traditional narcotics because it was a long-acting drug. But what also made this drug different was that it was introduced at a time when there was a real sea change taking place in medicine and in our perception of the risks of narcotics, and also because it was promoted far more aggressively and far more widely by its manufacturer than any other previous long-acting narcotic of its power.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about those two things. And the first being that, around the time that it was introduced, there was a small number of physicians, but a number that did grow over time, of doctors who were looking at the way pain was treated and who were saying that there are people who are suffering needlessly and that we should be more aggressive about our treatment of pain. Perhaps we shouldn't worry quite so much about the kind of medications that are available, particularly for their addictive properties. Essentially, they're saying, look, people are suffering, and that does not need to happen.
Right. Throughout the whole past 100 years, and I try to trace this the situation in the book, you know, our country has gone through a kind of love-hate relationship with this particular class of drugs, narcotics. We tend at various times to look at them as completely dark drugs. Anyone who will take them will become addicted to them. And then more recently, we've tended to look at them as totally, in reaction to that, as kind of white drugs where they really didn't hold any risk. Now, to set kind of things into time context, back in the 1980s was kind of a period where we were looking at these as dark drugs. We were very concerned about their risks, and as a result, lots of people with serious pain, cancer patients, etc., were being denied access to these drugs or weren't being given sufficient quantities of them to deal with their pain. Thus, a movement was born that became known as the pain management movement that began to advocate for a more humane and broader use of these drugs. But to kind of get that message across, they kind of had to shove the addictive side, or the potentially addictive side of narcotics into a black box and kind of set that off the stage. And so you kind of then came into an era where the real risks of these drugs, and there are real risks, were downplayed in order to make them more acceptable.
Now, it is true, though, that there were studies done that showed that, for example, people who were suffering with cancer or people who had other kinds of very severe pain, that for those people, if you gave them these narcotic drugs, that they did not become addicted.
Well, I mean, there certainly were studies that showed that the risk of addiction was small. I'm not aware of any studies that really show that people did not become addicted. I mean, cancer patients. I don't think you can look at all pain patients as a kind of single universe. Pain is a very multifaceted type of health problem. It can accompany problems like cancer. It can come out of chronic muscle injuries. It can have psychological components to it. So you really can't, you know, people tended to generalize from the experience of cancer patients, which was very positive, to the general community of pain patients. And in making that leap, there was really no evidence to support, well, what was going to be the impact here in more general pain patients.
Well, and that does get at the criticism that many people, physicians and people in government and people in law enforcement and people in the community that try to help folks who have substance abuse problems, all of those people, that's one of the criticisms they have leveled at the manufacturer of OxyContin is that the company, in the interest of making money, aggressively promoted the drug to physicians and went beyond the initial kind of groups that might have seemed to be good potential users for the medicine, that is cancer patients and people with extreme pain, and enlarged that universe and started suggesting that people with other kinds of pain were also appropriate, that also would be appropriate medication to treat them too.
Right. I mean, there's no question that the company did that. It was, you know, they were legally entitled to do that because of the way the government approved the drug, but they had a lot of, you know, sort of co-facilitators in this as well. It wasn't just the company. There were a lot of pain specialists who sort of believed in this, were strong components of broadening the use of this drug. The real problem developed, as far as I could see, in that broadening the use of this drug also brought it into the hands of many, many doctors who weren't really skilled in the use of these drugs, nor were they particularly trained to kind of look at their patients and say, you know, this patient could be, this drug could be a problem for this patient. This is not really a suitable candidate for this type of drug. I could give it to this patient, but not this other patient. And so basically you had what is essentially the most powerful drug available to treat pain being used to treat often moderate or less severe pain conditions. And I think once you start increasing the availability and accessibility of this kind of powerful narcotic, you're essentially asking for trouble, and trouble quickly followed.
Yeah. Our guest, let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might just have tuned in, Barry Meyer. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times and has authored a book on the subject here we're discussing, some of the problems associated with the prescription painkiller OxyContin. His title, book is titled Painkiller, the subtitle A Wonder Drug's Trail of Addiction and Death, and it's published by Rodale. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The manufacturer of this medication was not one of the big drug companies. What did it mean to Purdue Pharma, the maker of the drug, to be able to have this?
Well, for this company, Purdue Pharma, this was a blockbuster. I mean, this drug quickly became a billion-dollar drug. It quickly accounted for 70 to 80% of Purdue's sales, and it basically took it from the ranks of a kind of small family-owned company in Connecticut and set them on their path to becoming a major pharmaceutical manufacturer. In fact, they began giving speeches that this essentially was going to be our ticket, this drug was going to be our ticket to the big time. You know, their sales ranks doubled. It was kind of a boom time for this company. And I guess where I also raise criticism of the company in my book is, you know, raising the questions about, well, how did they react when, on the one hand, they were seeing this incredible explosion in sales, and then reports starting to dribble in, coming to their attention that this drug was being abused.
Well, the drug first became available in 1996. When was it that it started to be obvious that there were problems with abuse?
Well, I guess obvious is sort of a subjective word. Certainly, it became reports of abuse began to build in 1999, and then sort of exploded at the end of 1999 into early 2000. But what's very significant was that in 1998 there was also a report in the Journal of the Canadian Medical Association, which essentially undercut the theory that this drug was being marketed on. That is the idea that these longer-acting narcotics were less appealing, had less so-called abuse potential or abuse liability than shorter-acting narcotics. In fact, this study said that drug addicts and drug abusers would be drawn to these longer-acting drugs because they had far more narcotics in them than the shorter-acting drug. And, you know, the report said this should sound a warning bell. But, in fact, that bell was never sounded to the doctors who were prescribing this drug, as far as I could tell.
Well, obviously all manufacturers of prescription medications try to market their products. Now, increasingly, they're marketing to the general public, but historically they have marketed to doctors, and they have salespeople, and they drop in on doctors, and they glad-hand them, and they give away stuff, and they do everything they can to try to get the doctor to prescribe their medication, including, no doubt, providing them information on what they, the manufacturer, thinks are the benefits of the drugs.
Right.
Did the people who are representing Purdue Pharma do anything different than any other drug manufacturer?
No, I mean, they basically did what every drug manufacturer does, but the drug that they were doing it with here was a very, very high-powered narcotic that had significant consequences in the general population. Usually when there are problems with a drug, they usually manifest itself in the patient. You know, there's a side effect, you know, there's liver damage, there's this kind of damage. And when we read about problems with drugs, it usually has to do with problems that occur in patients taking these drugs for medical purposes. Here, the problem exploded in the greater community, and that's what made this story particularly interesting to me as a reporter.
Mm. Do you think, you started out talking about the pain management movement, something that started at about the same time that this drug started to become available, where some growing numbers of physicians, particularly people who specialized in dealing with pain, were saying to their fellow doctors, saying, look, you know, there are a lot of people in pain, and perhaps in the past we've been too conservative in treating this, and that was a mistake. We didn't need to. People are suffering needlessly. And there were a number of physicians that were very publicly speaking about that, talking with other doctors, in a sense, trying to spread this word. And that's something that the manufacturer of the drug obviously saw and really tried to take advantage of. Is there some way, I don't know if it's too harsh to say that they co-opted in part the very legitimate movement to get more aggressive treatment of pain, and that they did that simply because they were interested in selling more OxyContin?
Well, I mean, you can look at it cynically, or you could look at it sort of more sympathetically. I mean, there's no question that this manufacturer in particular, as well as others, nurtured both sort of emotionally and financially the pain management movement. Pain management experts will say, look, we had to take money from these companies because we weren't getting any research or money from the government. And in fact, that's true. The federal government really wasn't supporting any research into pain treatment. And again, bearing in mind that this pain management movement was a very legitimate, valid medical movement. But, you know, at a certain point, co-optation does take place. People do align themselves emotionally, psychologically, ideologically with a manufacturer potentially, as happened in this case, because their interests, their ideas, their visions really were aligned here. And, you know, one of the tragedies of this story is that many of these pain experts, the people that were advocating for these changes, did not stand up when they saw the abuse taking place because they were afraid that they were going to roll back the clock. The people that did stand up were small country doctors, including, you know, a character who's a central character in my book, a small town doctor in very western Virginia. He was the guy who stood up and spoke out on behalf of his community. It wasn't the pain management doctors that were doing it.
Hmm. The FDA has to approve medications for use and for specific uses, although it is true that any doctor can prescribe, I think, any medication for any, you know, they call it off-label use. Any doctor can do that. But generally speaking, you know, medicines are approved for specific kinds of use. And part of the selling feature, if you will, for OxyContin was that even though it had this very heavy load of narcotic, it was packaged in this time-release form. And so then the manufacturer could say, well, now this actually makes it less likely that this drug is going to be abused. So I guess I'm going back to how it is the FDA approached the approval for the drug and what they said this drug should be good for, and whether you think, in fact, that also government regulators really ignored what was a potentially very large problem at the outset.
I think that, you know, that the government regulators blew it virtually all down the line here. Mm-hmm. I mean, they certainly blew it at the beginning, because they did not require Purdue, or if it had been any other manufacturer, to making the same claim, to actually run tests to determine this. There was not a single test that was run with this particular drug prior to its release to support the theory, and it really was just the theory that this drug would be less prone to abuse. It was basically an idea, a theory that was extrapolated from reports about other drugs, but this drug itself, this kind of narcotic, had never been tested. And for the government, the FDA, to have approved this labeling on that basis, I consider to be scandalous.
Mm. Well, is it, when people are looking at potentially hazardous drugs, particularly like this, is it common that they do testing looking at the ways in which people might use this drug other than the way that it's intended to try to determine whether indeed there is a potential problem, because what happened here, it was
right.
formulated in a particular way
right.
intended that someone's going to swallow it. Well,
they certainly yeah. can do that yeah. testing. There are laboratories that specialize in that testing, and some companies have done such testing. To the best of my knowledge, in this particular case, this testing was not done by the manufacturer. You know, essentially, they didn't take a bunch of drug addicts or drug abusers, sit them in a room and say, okay, guys and ladies, here, let me pour some of these pills out on the table in front of you. What would you do? How would you get, you know, how would you get your best high out of this drug? That was never done, to the best of my knowledge.
When it became, when more and more people started noticing that there was a problem, and in particular you pointed to the physician that you talked about, some people said, well, you know, there's one relatively easy thing that we could do, simple thing we could do to stop this, and that was to change the formulation of the drug, and that it would be possible to change it in a way so that a person taking it in the appropriate way would still get the desired effect, but that the abusers who had found that way around that could continue doing what they were doing, but then it wouldn't work for them. Is that and so how did the company respond to that suggestion that by changing the way that they manufacture it, changing the formula, then that would take care of this serious problem?
Well, I mean, the problem being is that it wasn't simple. The quick fix or the purported quick fix wasn't quick or easy, and the company has been working for several years to try to do what, you know, incorporate essentially what's known as an opiate blocker into the drug, and has not succeeded. Other manufacturers recently have patented other versions of this drug that contain sort of this safeguard, if you will, but they're really in the testing stage now, and they haven't advanced to the marketplace, so we don't know once they got onto the market whether they would be successful in achieving that goal.
So the other thing that I guess that would have been easier that also the people who were concerned about this problem suggested is that the manufacturer should put the word out to all physicians, to anybody who might think about prescribing the drug, that that there was this potential problem, and so that it ought to be prescribed with great care and only in the situations where it was really needed and really appropriate. How did the company respond to that?
Well, they didn't. Not until much later. Essentially, you know, I sketch out some scenes in the book where this particular physician, whose name was Art Van Zee, you know, approaches the company, one of their scientists and said, look, I want you to send a letter out to every doctor in the country. Tell them what's going on. You know, warn them about this. Tell them about this. And, you know, he essentially gets blown off. I mean, what really sort of propelled, I believe anyway, and, you know, the company to do it was newspaper coverage in papers like The Times that cast a spotlight on the dimensions of this problem. The company was was characterizing this as isolated in a little few towns here and there, it was not until July of 2001. After the company had extensive negotiations with the FDA, that they sent a letter out to every doctor apprising them of this before they had simply asked their salesman to do so and to change some, describe the drug a little differently. But as far as a direct letter, warning letter to the doctor, that did not happen until July of 2001.
We are getting close here to the midpoint of the program. I'd just like to introduce again our guest, Barry Meyer. He is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. He's been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize for his work. In 2002, he received a George Polk Award for Outstanding Journalism, and he's written about OxyContin. He wrote about it for the paper, for The New York Times, and now he has a book-length treatment discussing a lot of the issues that we here have been talking about. The title of the book is Painkiller, and the subtitle of Wonder Drugs, Trail of Addiction and Death, and it is published by Rodale. It is out now in bookstores if you would like to read the book. And, of course, here, questions and comments are welcome. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The company that makes OxyContin, Purdue Pharma, is privately held. So you don't have the access that you might to the decision-making process, to how people in the company think, that you would if this was a publicly held company. And they have been – they've not been inclined to open up to you, and I'm sure not to other reporters. Do you have some sense, or is there any way of saying how company management really thought about this and what sort of discussion there was about, A, whether there was a problem, and B, what to do about it?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had some better insight into that. I really don't. I mean, anything I would say at this point would be sheer speculation. But it would be fascinating to know, because here you have a company that, you know, one day or is thinking it's on the top of the world. It's got a drug that's going to, you know, pulling in $1 billion a year from this drug, and then suddenly kaplooey. You know, it starts getting little dribs and drabs of information, and then it starts to become more of a steady stream, and suddenly there's a flood. And, you know, I had hoped when I was working on the book to kind of document that in the book, but as you said, the company declined to be interviewed by me and really hasn't made itself available to any reporter or journalist. And, you know, you can kind of understand that when you're looking at maybe 300 or 400 lawsuits, which the company is looking at now.
Mm-hmm. This was and is a prescription medication. So you have to go to a physician and they got to write you a script so you can go out and get the medicine. How is it that, you know, given the fact that there is that kind of control, that this and apparently some other medications like it have become so widely abused? I mean, what really is the problem? Because someone's got to be writing prescriptions for these.
Well, you know, David, one of the fascinating things, you know, I think that I try to deal with in the book, and because the book is about OxyContin, but it's really talking about this whole new era of abuse that's taking place that we see unfolding around us now, and that's the era of narcotic painkiller abuse. As you mentioned in your opening, this is now the second most abused drug in the country, and one areas of drugs that is growing in abuse rather than declining. You know, I think a lot of it has to do with, it's the availability of these drugs, in some part the increased prescription of these drugs in recent years, but, you know, they make their way into, you know, out of the medical sphere in various ways. One is inappropriate prescribing. Two is over the internet. You know, I don't know whether you get bombarded as I do with internet advertisements mm-hmm. for, you know, Vicodin and other types of painkillers. Some of it is smuggled into the country. But we're basically awash in these drugs right now, to the point where I think you may have mentioned in your opening that, you know, the federal government, the White House, has now pointed to prescription drug abuse as the most significant drug problem we face at the moment.
How much of this, if we look at prescriptions that are written by physicians, would be physicians who are writing carelessly, who may in fact be somehow benefiting, and in that sense, and others that are just that are prescribing, and they think that they're prescribing appropriately, but that they're not thinking carefully enough about whether this is the right medicine for that particular patient.
Well, I mean, I think the doctors who are running so-called pill mills or script mills, who you can go to pay, you know, $100 for a physical, and they'll write you any prescription you want, really are, you know, are a tiny minority of physicians, though the damage they can cause is, you know, inversely proportional to their numbers, because you can just have huge floods of these drugs coming out of such offices. I mean, these are the real criminals that somehow have managed to also get medical licenses. The other side is doctors who are honestly doing their jobs, who are getting either scammed by patients who are, you know, addicted to drugs, out of these drugs, or who lack the time or the inclination to be more discriminating in how they prescribe. I mean, you have general practitioners in many parts of the country who are, you know, seeing hundreds of patients a week. They have 5 to 10 minutes to spend with a patient, and that's really not enough time to identify whether this is a patient that's prone, that has an underlying substance abuse problem, that if you prescribe them a particular pill or narcotic, may end up abusing and becoming addicted to that drug. Hmm.
Well, it seems that's the kind of thing that that you could address in a couple of ways. You put some responsibility on the manufacturer to say to physicians, look, this is a very serious drug and treat it with respect. Also, the FDA could put out a message like that. Also, physician organizations could do the same thing. So it seems that a piece of this is educating physicians to make sure that they are aware of the potential for the medication so that they are prescribing it, one would hope, in only the appropriate cases, and saving that if they have somebody who comes in who has pain, finding some other way to treat that and saving these most powerful drugs as your last line of defense against extreme pain.
Well, I would like to think that is what has been going on in the last year or two, you know, mm-hmm. with the intense, you know, scrutiny of OxyContin in particular, although OxyContin really is more a representative drug rather than, you know, a particular drug in and of itself. I think as a result of the OxyContin episode, however, there is this type of awareness and there is this type of education that's going on. It's going to take a while, but at least it's now heading in an appropriate direction.
We have a caller and would welcome others if you have questions. 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Caller here in Champaign on our line number one.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a chronic pain sufferer. I was injured in several car accidents. I used to be a driver's license examiner, actually, and was hurt on the job a number of times. Many back surgeries. And I just want to point out that I never got OxyContin. I got oxycodone a couple of times when the pain was super severe, and I get Vicodin fairly routinely, but even that is stopping. And now, because of all of this heightened scrutiny, my doctor, who has prescribed this stuff for me without really any problem in the past, I mean, the pain is there, and he knows it's there, and now that there's so much more scrutiny, he will just, you know, sometimes I have to be absolutely, utterly, unbelievably crippled by pain before he'll give me anything. Yeah. And I just think that the other side of this is that people don't understand that all of this publicity and all this scrutiny now is also making it very hard for people who really are in pain to actually receive the treatment that was once pretty fairly easy to get. I understand that it's a good thing that it be scrutinized. I really do. I don't think that it should be. I don't think this stuff should be out there. It's very powerful stuff, but I do think that there are many people, myself, that just occasionally need it. And it gets to the point where, I mean, I have to literally be in a fetal ball sometimes before he'll give me stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's I think that's a perfectly important point to make, and also part of the story that I know that our guest you know deals with. What do you think about that, Mr.?
Well, I mean, I think there's no question that people that suffer from pain, like the caller, should have access to these types of drugs. I mean, unfortunately, the way that this problem has been posited often is, you know, there's a kind of, you know, it's a trade-off, or it's sort of like drug abusers on one side and pain patients on the other side, and you know we're denying one, making stuff available to the other. I mean, I think doctors need to act responsibly. Doctors acting responsibly mean getting drugs to people who need them and keeping the drugs away from people who don't need them. And I don't think doctors need to be afraid about prescribing the drugs that their patients need. I know there's been a lot of publicity of late that there's some, you know, DEA war on doctors. You know, the statistics really don't bear that out at the moment. I mean, we don't have, you know, trucks going around sweeping up doctors. Doctors need to be responsible. Doctors got to say, this guy's a pain patient. he gets the drugs, this person may be a pain patient, but maybe I can treat him with a less significant drug, and that's really the doctor's decision to make.
Well, I agree with that. What I disagree with is the way you're presenting it is the way I would like to hear it presented more often. The way it's presented often on the news and in the mainline media is that this is a horrible problem and we need to get rid of this drug. And unfortunately, for someone who gets 2 or 3 hours of sleep between pain pills because the pain wakes him up, I dream of the day when I could have 8 hours of sleep, you know?
Well, I mean, in the book, I certainly, and I've never advocated it in any newspaper article I write, but certainly in the book, I don't advocate having this or any other drug, any other pain medication withdrawn really from the market. I mean, I don't think that solves anyone's problem. What I do feel very, very strongly about is the need for doctors to use this drug like any other drug, or these types of drugs like any other types of drugs, in the appropriate patients, and to monitor their use appropriately, and also to use drugs selectively in patients. I think that's best for the patient and best for the general population as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. I guess I the caller was pointing out towards something, and you said in response to his comments that it was not the case that the DEA was going around sweeping up doctors, but I guess the impression that I got is that there are doctors that are concerned that someone might be monitoring their
right.
prescribing practices,
right.
and so they might, for that reason, they might be less inclined to prescribe the drug or give less of it, or and so that there might be patients like this one who really needs a medicine like this that's not getting it just because the doctor is kind of nervous that somebody's going to be looking over his or her shoulder and looking at how many prescriptions for medicines like this they're writing.
Right. In fact, one of the sort of battle cries of the pain management movement was that there was so-called opiophobia, that there was a phobic reaction by doctors to prescribe opiates like OxyContin because a number of states had these prescription monitoring programs or had active state-level DEAs that could tell when a doctor was prescribing these kinds of drugs and then would then come in and say, look, either you're like a reckless doctor or you're a drug dealer or you're blah, 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 and that there was a chilling effect within the larger medical community, and doctors tended not to prescribe drugs, the point that you've just made. That's possible. I mean, that could be happening now to some degree as a result of all the coverage of the drug and the problems with this particular drug and these classes of drugs. Nonetheless, doctors still need to prescribe patients these drugs, and the doctor really has to make that decision, him or herself. I mean, the government has said that they're not going to bust doctors who prescribe legitimately, regardless of how much they prescribe. Is that the case? Do you want to risk your medical license on that? I don't know, but a doctor's principal responsibility is to their patient. And, doctors have to fulfill that responsibility.
Let's talk with someone else. The next person is in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I tuned in late, so I may be repetitive. Continuing on from what this last person who called was talking about, and I feel for him and those who are suffering to the extent that he is, or even lesser extent, and continuing on with your last comments, I read an article quite a while ago which said, in effect, that as a general rule, American doctors do not prescribe painkillers to the extent that painkillers are prescribed in Europe, and part of that is that they claim that they don't want people to become addicted to the drugs that they would prescribe otherwise, the painkillers. And this is even people who are on their deathbeds and in terrible pain, which seems rather ridiculous.
Well, I think that may have been the case many years ago, back in the 80s, when there was, you know, aggressive treatment of cancer pain in Europe, particularly in England, and that there was not in this country. Unfortunately, that kind of pain began to be treated aggressively through the activities of some doctors in this country, and that has caught on, and that's a very, very good thing. But as to the broader point, I don't know of any evidence that suggests that painkillers in general are less prescribed in this country. In fact, you know, the American appetite for pills, be it, you know, tranquilizers or painkillers or any other type of prescription medication, it far exceeds those of most other countries in the volume of these drugs being prescribed in the United States. That's not in any way to diminish the concerns that this current caller and the previous caller raised. But again, you know, we've gone through these cycles, and I try to trace them in the book of, you know, reaction and counter-reaction, reaction and counter-reaction. You know, there are too many of these drugs being prescribed. Now people are suffering because too few of these drugs are being prescribed. And, you know, we really kind of have to find some middle ground where the same arguments and counter-reactions are not recycled and recycled and recycled. Because, you know, on the one hand, pain patients need to be getting these drugs. On the second hand, these drugs cannot be prescribed indiscriminately because there are significant public health consequences as a result.
Just one comment. The article that I read about 5, maybe 8 years ago at the earliest, the writer was describing the situation as it was then, I presume.
Yeah, well, there's been an explosion in the prescription of these drugs over, really, the last 8 years or so, really since the mid-1990s. And, unfortunately, there's been an explosion of public health consequences as well, and that's the kind of dilemma that we find ourselves in now.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Our guest this morning in this hour, Focus 580, Barry Meyer, is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's written about OxyContin for the newspaper and also in a book-length treatment. The book is titled Painkiller, A Wonder Drug's Trial of Addiction and Death, and Rodale is the publisher. Next, we'll go to someone on a cell phone. This is line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, this is going to sound like a broken record, but as someone who was in an accident and was on painkillers for a while, and that was the only way I could possibly sleep more than 2 hours without waking up, I think that the drug warriors need to be very, very, very careful because there's a lot of legitimate use of this stuff. Anyway, I really think that I'm going to ask you to put this in the larger context to the drug war, because I think, given how draconian the drug war has become, I can understand why a doctor would go, "The heck with it! I'm not. You can't ask me to give up. You know, run the risk of this." I mean, maybe they're overestimating the risk. That very, very well may be, but you know, given the undermining of given what's been done in the name of anti-drug in many other cases, I can see a doctor might, you know, just say, "Geez, you're asking me to ruin my life." You know, if I have people looking over my shoulder, and I think the chilling effect is probably quite present and very strong. So can you put this in the context of the larger drug war? And I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, Mr. Meyer?
I don't know in particular what the caller means by the larger drug war. I mean, this is a very specific problem. This is a problem that deals with making drugs available to certain patients and trying to control the public health consequences of making these drugs too available. They're both legitimate issues. And what we need to do is find an appropriate balance between them. what we're doing, and I sort of sense it from the calls, you know, this is an issue that's kind of perceived from the extremes. And both people at both sides of the argument have legitimate arguments to perceive it from the extremes. But I truly believe that people of good faith can find ways of making these drugs available to the people who need them while protecting the public interest at the same time.
Something that we really haven't talked very much about, and I wanted to do justice to that piece of the story, is just how serious a problem abuse of this medicine and others like it, just how serious a problem this is. And that is also something you devote significant amounts of the book too. And maybe we can, I should give you the opportunity to talk a little bit more about that.
Well, it's a tremendously serious problem. I think, you know, that the abuse of prescription drugs is probably the leading problem that we're faced with in the United States right now. It's a problem that cuts through every segment of our society. I mean, most vivid example recently involved Rush Limbaugh. But more troublingly, it's affecting a lot of young people. Lots of teenagers. I mean, I trace the life of one particular girl in my book who becomes addicted to OxyContin and the tremendous havoc that causes in her life and that of her family. I mean, we are now faced with a situation where a generation of kids are coming of age. When I came of age many, many years ago, the leading drug of abuse was marijuana. You could abuse that drug and then move on with the rest of your life. And myself and most of my friends did. Today you have a generation of kids coming of age where the drug of abuse of choice is often a prescription narcotic. And that drug is going to have far more severe consequences for those teenagers than we really understand and imagine. And it is a terrible dilemma that we're facing right now.
I'm sure there would have been a time when a lot of people would have said that drug abuse was an urban problem, and now it seems no longer to respect that kind of division. And certainly in rural areas, we have seen significant problems with amphetamine use and manufacture. Is this particular case, is it something, now the story that you focused on was indeed in a rural area, it was in
right.
Appalachia, but is this something that seems particularly to be more of a problem in rural areas, or is that just you just chose to
this particular drug kind of popped up there, but as far as the broader story of prescription drug abuse is concerned, it's certainly not a problem that's limited to rural areas. I was just on a college a campus a while ago giving a talk about these subjects and about the book, and, kids were coming up to me and telling me about, you know, these parties that they have, where kids arrive with, you know, basically drugs that they get either on the street or from their parents, and they have something called pharming, pharming, where they kind of pour these drugs into a bowl, and kids kind of pop pills and drink a couple of beers and get high. The tragedy is that, you know, teenagers are, like, overdosing. Teenagers are dying. Teenagers are getting addicted. Teenagers are engaging in activity that is going to have severe consequences for the rest of their lives. And these are the kids that we really need to be concerned about and protecting. That doesn't mean that these drugs shouldn't be made available to pain patients. No one's saying that. But there are many, many steps that can be taken to reduce the public health consequences of having these many drugs available to too many people. I mean, there's no reason why these drugs should be available over the internet. There's no reason why people should be able to get these drugs by filling out some form and sending it over the internet, where some doctor who's got a medical degree and is still allowed to continue to practice can then, you know, write a prescription for these drugs. I think pain patients should be the ones who should be up in arms about this, because it is the availability of these drugs and the abuse of the availability of these drugs that is making making their lives difficult and making their access to these drugs difficult, they're the ones that really should be sort of in the forefront of leading the charge against this type of behavior.
We have another caller in Chicago, line four. Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, well, first of all, in the last comment, most of your people that are legitimately on OxyContin can't lead a charge anywhere. They're having enough trouble just handling their lives. What I wanted to call, I believe there's that expression, let 10 guilty men go rather than put one innocent person in jail. And I think that applies here in this case. We've always had crooked doctors. We've always had abusers. And I think anything that we do that puts pressure or increases the possibility of someone who really needs this medication from getting it is inhumane. And I think we have to stop suing McDonald's for cheeseburgers that get us fat, and we simply have to stop spending so much time and worry about people who want to be abusers. And in the process of trying to legislate against these abusers, we ultimately might hurt the people that need this medication the most. I'll hang up now and listen to your response.
Well, I know that we've really addressed this, I think, probably more than once, and certainly you've said, Mr. Meyer, that you think that it ought to be possible to make it so that people who need the medicine can get it and that the people who shouldn't can't. There's really no reason why we can't satisfy both of those concerns.
Yes, and I think, you know, this last comment, while understandable, you know, kind of reflects a denial. And it's a denial that does not benefit either the pain patient or the greater public health problem. And I hope that, you know, that people's consideration of this issue kind of moves beyond that denial and gets into dealing with what some solutions to these problems might be.
I think we're at the point that we're going to have to stop because we've used up the time. And I want to, though, again, mention that if you're interested in reading more on the subject, you should look for the book that we have been talking about here this morning. It's titled Painkiller, and that's two words, Painkiller, A Wonder Drug's Trail of Addiction and Death. That's the subtitle. It's published by Rodale and came out actually last fall by our guest, Barry Meyer. He is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. And Mr. Meyer, we just want to say to you, thanks very much. We certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. We also want you to know that this show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. That's about where we're going to have to finish up here on Focus. Of course, we want you to stay tuned because coming up next, it'll be the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host for that show. It will feature the usual mix of news and weather and sports and features, a chance to call in with a forecast if you're going to be traveling, and in the 1 o'clock hour, another conversation. And Celeste Quinn, I think, is the host for the show.
I am.
Hi.
As a matter of fact, good Friday morning to you. We've got 2 minutes left of this morning. And thanks, David, for that introduction. In the 1 o'clock hour today of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at our ideas about living and dying. We'll talk with a Tibetan Buddhist monk by the name of Robert Thurman. He'll join us following the 1 o'clock news. He says to live well is to engage in the world fully. His latest book is Infinite Life, 7 Virtues for Living Well. We'll talk with him at 1:06 Central Time. Let's take a look at prices on the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. May wheat, $3.95.5, that down 2.5. July, $3.98.5, down 2.5. May corn, $3.13.5, up 1.5. July corn, $3.18.